Welcome to Views from the World Tree. On today's episode, we look at where our food comes from, the future of where our food may come from, and anything else that comes to mind while discussing the topic of agriculture. And now, on with the show.
Personal news this week for me is pretty slim. Been pretty busy with work. We're expanding into overseas. We're expanding our overseas team, rather. And I'm pretty heavily involved in the stand-up of that. So been working a lot of long days, 9:30, 10 o'clock some nights. Anyway, so personal news, I got a new office chair. It's exciting for me because I spend 10 to 12 hours a day in it. I had a pretty fancy DX racer chair. Problem is, I'm a big boy. I've got some broad shoulders, and those wraparound racing style seats just don't fit guys like me. So this one, it's pretty comfy so far. It's made by Secret Lab. Anyway. And then other than that, the only other thing that's changed in my life is we're dog sitting for some friends. So here in my house, we are currently at a ratio of 3 dogs to 2 humans and 4 girls to 1 guy. So between my wife and the 3 female dogs, I'm just kind of here all by my lonesome in a sea of estrogen.
I can think of worse things to deal with than being surrounded by women.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I guess I'll go into my news. The big news is I am on quarantine. I was exposed to somebody that had the coronavirus and came down with a pretty wicked cough last night. I'm assuming it's a cold, but I called into work and they said, if you come in here, we will just ask you to leave. I need you to go get tested. And I said, okay. So I went and had somebody jam swabs up my nose today and I'm awaiting test results. Fingers crossed that it comes back negative.
Yeah, hopefully. I guess if you lose your sense of taste, then...
Yeah. So far, everything has tasted like it should, so I think I'm okay in that regard. But
it's still just the weirdest symptom. Like, I mean, I'm not a doctor. I have pretty much no virology training, but it's such a weird and oddly specific symptom.
It really is. I was talking, so one of my coworkers, he had it a couple weeks ago. He's back now. Everything's fine. But he said the weirdest thing was he couldn't taste anything. He said he'd drink his coffee and it tasted like hot water. There was no taste to it whatsoever. He said, at one point, just to see if he could taste something, he actually put a little bit of toothpaste onto his burrito. Still nothing.
Oh.
It's weird for us. He said, I couldn't taste anything. My stomach definitely felt that that was not food. But I couldn't taste it.
Oh, man. Ugh. Gross.
I guess if you're sitting there 3 or 4 days without being able to taste anything, you're willing to try anything.
Yeah, but I mean, I'd take a bite out of an onion or something before I put toothpaste on a burrito. You know, gargle some sriracha, but
go to the grocery store and buy a little bundle of cilantro and take a bite out of that. I mean, there's ways around.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, when you're on quarantine, you're not exactly allowed to leave the house. So.
Yeah, true. So.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear he recovered.
Yeah. So far, everybody that's gotten sick has recovered at work. So.
Good.
Yep. And then the news that I was going to share when I was doing my part in the show notes earlier this week was I finally broke down and subscribed to Discovery Plus. And so far, I'm not that impressed.
Like with the shows or the app or what?
Both. The app's clunky. The show selection. I think I had this idea in my mind that it was going to be the old stuff, like back when Discovery was still an over-the-air station and you didn't have to pay for it. And they kind of shared the nature documentaries and whatnot. And I guess I haven't watched enough and rated enough because it still thinks that I want to watch this silly dating reality show called 90 Days or something. And it's every single show that it is recommending me has this, oh, what will you do if you move across the sea instead of having your future spouse move to be with you? How hard will it be? And like, no, I don't want to know that. I want to watch submarines discover the Titanic. I want to watch the Mars program. I want to watch what Discovery was like when I was younger. So
yeah, that's fair. I've had Discovery Plus for a hot minute now, and it makes me feel old in a way because a lot of the stuff that I want to watch is under there, like the classics or whatever it's called. So but I think one of the first things I watched was binged all the seasons of Dirty Jobs, because I had always loved that show when it was on the air, but you know, it was always at an awkward time. So it was really cool to go back and watch the show progress over like 9 or 10 seasons, I think.
Wow.
So
yeah, I started watching Gold Rush Whitewater, which is the spinoff where they go further up and towards the glacier runoff and are trying to get gold from the rapids part of the Yukon River.
Nice.
So far, it's about as informative as the original Gold Rush. It's a bunch of people making stupid mistakes, and you're sitting there going, you all are idiots, but it's entertaining.
Yeah, and it's engaging, which is why shows like that do well.
Yeah.
My guilty pleasure as far as Discovery reality shows is called Homestead Rescue.
Oh, I love that show.
It's a total like classic reality show manufactured drama, but I'm into that stuff, so not the drama, the homesteading.
You heard it here, folks. I should clarify. Adam is interested in manufacturing drama.
Oh, my wife would probably believe that. No, I'm just kidding.
No, my wife and I, during the height of the pandemic, every Sunday, because they do back-to-back episodes for for the morning of Homestead Rescue, we'd watch that.
I think it plays to some fantasy I have that one of these days I'm going to have the money to move off grid, go to Alaska, and you know, make a 200 acre homestead. It'll probably never happen, but it's fun to live vicariously.
If it ever does happen, I will gladly come help you homestead.
Nice.
Just give me like 50 acres and hopefully next to a water so I can do some fly fishing when I'm up there.
There you go. Anyway, off on tangents, like always, but...
Yes? I see. Good news, everyone!
So for current events, I'll be honest, I didn't really have one until about 5 minutes before we started recording. And this news alert came up in the Apple News app that the FBI has reopened the Jimmy Hoffa investigation. So Jimmy Hoffa, I'm sure that most people are aware, was, you know, a notorious mob boss back in the 60s, 50s, 60s. And he disappeared in the mid 70s and his body's never been found. It's always been a bit of an urban legend about what happened to him. Supposedly, he was buried at the 50-yard line of a football stadium at some point. And anyway, they've been searching for him for a while, but they were talking to the son of one of the underbosses, the underboss that was charged with disposing of Jimmy Hoffa. And so this underboss's son said that his dad had told him pretty much exactly where and how he had disposed of the body, specifically that it was in a 55-gallon metal drum, and that he dug a hole with an excavator like 12 feet down and then piled empty drums on top of the one that had his body in it. So they were like, okay, well, whatever, we'll go check. And so it was actually one of the news agencies that hired a company that does ground penetrating radar because nobody wanted to believe this guy's story. So they did a survey, and in this location that, you know, nobody had really any reason to suspect there was anything there, and ground penetrating radar says, yeah, there's a bunch of metal drums under there, buried one on top of the other, starting about 4 feet down. So it's like, well, maybe there's some credibility to it.
I'm sure this underboss is like, I'm old, I'm tired. Y'all have already arrested me. I've got nothing else going on. Yeah. I'll tell you right where he is.
So anyway, it'll be interesting to see if that, that chapter finally comes to a close after like 50 years.
Oh, that's so crazy.
Yep.
And he, so, I can't remember which crime family was he head of? The Gotti?
Don't remember.
I can see through your glasses that you're looking it up.
It says, let's see. It says former member of the powerful Genovese or Genovese.
Oh, okay, family. Genovese. That's okay.
So, yeah, claimed that after Hoffa was killed in Detroit, his body was shipped in a 55-gallon drum on a truck and buried at this location, which they call Moscato's Dump.
That makes sense, because I think the Genoveses were big in the Teamster Union, so anything transportation they had a monopoly on, right?
Yeah, that was how it all started. Anyway, future episode. There you go.
There you go. I've been thinking of a couple myself. I've been watching on... Back to personal news. On Amazon Prime, I've been watching Hunting Hitler, which is all about the theory nice. That Hitler did not die in the bunker, but actually escaped to Argentina. So, future news, or future show right there, too.
Oh, there's a German community in Argentina, I know.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been told, anyway. But,
yeah. Anyway, I guess my current event... earlier this week, I've been kind of following the tweets and whatnot of the COP26, that whole climate action plan thing. And they've been, there's been a lot of articles that have been coming out, but one really caught my attention. It's from the news agency Fast Company, which usually deals with technology and whatnot. And the article, if you want to look it up, it's called How One London Suburb Reduced Its Morning Traffic by 53%. And basically the premise is in the UK, only about 37% of people above the age of 16 will travel actively to work. And when they say travel actively, they mean ride your bike, walk, scoot, that type of thing. And so they were trying to figure out a way to reduce congestion on the streets as well as improve like their greenhouse gas emissions and whatnot. And so they decided to try something. They called it gamification, which is basically offering a points, prizes, or a leaderboard for non-game related activities. If you all remember, maybe 5 years ago, there was a popular app called Foursquare, where you basically checked in when you went to a restaurant.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that.
Checked in so many times, you became mayor of that restaurant. It was a completely arbitrary title. You had no power. There was nothing there, but you could say, hey, on this app, I own this restaurant. So that's kind of gamification, like taking mundane things and turning it into a game. So this game, they called it Beat the Street in Hounslow, which is a suburb of London. And they ran it from September 18th to October 30th in 2019. And what they did is they put these little boxes on street lamps and things and gave each player a card. And if you were walking, every time you passed one of those boxes, you'd tap your card. And if you tapped subsequent boxes, and they were always spaced a certain distance away, you would get 10 points for each subsequent box that you tapped. And then they put the winners up on a leaderboard and remove cheaters. I didn't get into it, but I assume the company that does Pokemon Go, Niantic, partnered with Google and basically tried to figure out what walking times were between Pokestops so they can figure out what the average human does to commute between spots.
Gotcha.
So I assume that they used similar things to figure out who would tap a box and then get into a car and drive down a couple blocks and then tap the next box or whatnot, you know.
Okay.
But the top of the leadership got vouchers from local stores for sports equipment, free books, or like crafting materials.
Interesting.
Which is kind of cool. Some of the stats, which were really kind of cool, 28,219 people took part in this game, which is about 9.6% of the population.
Wow. It's a big suburb.
Of the 30,000 that played, they combined traveled over 96,000 miles during that month of play. And they found that most of the boxes tapped occurred during the morning and evening commutes. And so this game got people actually walking to and from work rather than driving. And then their data analysis, what they did is they looked at through CCTV cameras, which if you're not aware, the UK is notorious for recording everything that you do when you're out in public. CCTV is everywhere.
Top Gear taught me that.
But they looked at the main thoroughfares in and out of town, pre-game and post-game, and they saw a 53% reduction in traffic.
Wow.
And so, as I was reading this, I'm going, oh, that's interesting, that's interesting. They made mention that cars are status symbols, that usually people who with money buy the fancier cars and don't want to stop driving it. And, like, there's one of the commenters at the bottom of the article, he theorized, well, by adding these leaderboards of people walking, does that replace the car as the status symbol? Is that why it was so popular? Is because you got that status symbol of being first rather than the status symbol of driving around in your brand new BMW or whatnot.
Yeah, it could be. It's a good question for, I don't know, human philosophy, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I just thought that entire social experiment, gamification of commuting and all of that was just a fascinating fascinating idea.
Yeah, I wonder how long it would maintain its effectiveness. So but yeah, if they could find a way to incentivize that long term, it's not an insignificant amount of cars removed from the road.
I'm curious. I'm more curious about if they did like create a local program with restaurants that gave you coupons and stuff for being top of the leaderboard, if you wouldn't see that die off. Like when Pokemon Go comes out with a new patch, you see a bunch of people outside walking around with their phones. And then after about a month, it goes down and people are no longer out there except for like little bits and here and there. And then it kind of dies off until the next expansion or the next content comes out.
Yeah, maybe those real world incentives are what it needs.
Yeah, so that's my news. Not nice. Near as exciting as possibly finding one of the most notorious gangsters of our of the last century, but still, I thought it was cool. As we approach the main topic, I would like to apologize to my co-host, as I feel like I kind of hijacked the topic this week and possibly threw him under the bus to an extent, but...
That's all good.
our topic this week is all about agriculture, and we kind of chose this because in America and Canada, so in the North Americas, we celebrate something called Thanksgiving, and it's a kind of a non-denominational holiday where we take some time to express gratitude and come together as friends, families, neighbors, and eat a giant meal in the most American way ever and stuff ourselves with so much food that we can't move. And then about 90% of the family sits on the couch and watches TV, while the other 10% of the family that unfortunately is also the same 10% of the family that busted their butt for 2 days cooking this grand meal clean up. Anything to add for Thanksgiving?
That's how I remember it.
So we chose farming and agriculture kind of to share where our food comes from. Jamie Oliver did a little bit. He did a show here in the United States talking to inner cities kids and showing them, hey, this lettuce that's on your burger comes from the ground, and this is what it looks like, and like this is what burger comes from. And just to see the awe in these kids that have never even thought about it kind of got me thinking, hey, how many people actually really think about where our food comes from?
That's a good point. I mean I would assume that most people have an idea. I know I've seen some, you know, some like meme videos shared where, you know, somebody's talking about like slaughtering animals or hunting, I guess, is where I see it a lot. Somebody will post something on social media, because of course that's all people do, about hunting, and somebody will reply and say, oh, it's so like horrific. How could you go and, you know, harvest an animal? Like, why can't you just be civilized and buy your meat from the grocery store?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, in a way, I try to give them credit and say, okay, well, maybe they're just pointing out that the act of going and taking the life of an animal is something that a lot of people are not comfortable with. But part of me also wonders, like, is it ignorance? Is it, I don't think it's malicious, but, you know, obviously meat that ends up in the grocery store, those are animals that get slaughtered too. And having worked on ranches and having hunted for most of my life, I can tell you that the wild game is usually harvested more humanely and has a better life up until that point. So
yeah, that's usually where I see it too. It's either that or those silly PETA billboards that you see in big cities, basically saying, where do we draw the line?
I've seen some pretty good memes of those too.
Yeah. But I guess I'll just start by saying, like, the current practices of agriculture, it's kind of archaic. You buy a seed, you put a seed in the ground, you water the seed, and then you harvest what grows. I mean, yeah. Which really doesn't like create this awesome podcast topic. But the reason why I wanted to talk about current things is there's practices like flood irrigation. You see it very common in middle America, where there's a lot of corn, where people will open up their farmer's canal and completely flood the field. And mm-hmm. it'll run all the way down the field and usually isn't captured by another irrigation ditch, at least not where I grow up. Where I live, it runs down the field, comes to the end of the field, hits a little culvern, and then leaks onto the highway. So that's one of the things that some of the modern technology is trying to get rid of. There's also a lot of use of herbicides and pesticides, and a lot of chemicals go into our food. And I'm not trying to be all hippy dippy and be like, oh yeah, you should eat organic because they don't use these chemicals and all that. Chemicals have their place. I mean, science got us here for a reason. But there is like this old school mentality of, this is the way my dad did it, which is the way his dad did it, which is the way his dad did it. And his dad would have done it if we had a diesel tractor, and then his dad would have done it if he had a horse. And, you know, there's a lot of tradition in farming. So
true.
Anyway, what's your thoughts on the modern practice? I feel like I kind of hijacked that.
I mean, so I'll be honest, I was really exposed to farming, well, gardening, I guess, large-scale gardening, we'll say, at a young age. And it was very much, you know, because it was just like a family or a couple family operation, it was all very manual. So I'm intimately familiar with, you know, digging the furrows by hand. You know, planting the seeds, watering by hand, weeding, harvesting, all of that. No pesticides, no, you know, the most modern thing we used was a shovel and a hoe. As far as like what I would say actual agriculture is, I have probably more in-depth than average knowledge, but I'm by no means an expert. So I think that overall technology in farming has, you know, been a good thing, but at the same time, kind of like you alluded to, really all of the technological advances has just been finding ways to do the same thing faster and on a bigger scale. So all of the, you know, seed drills and combine harvesters, all of these modern machines, they're still doing the exact same process. They're just doing it, you know, more seeds at a time, right? They're harvesting more things at a time. So I don't know. In some ways, it's really cool to see what technology has done to agriculture, but at the same time, I keep wondering, like, okay, when are we actually going to get like a true paradigm shift in how we obtain our food? You know, are we ever going to get to the point where, you know, we don't have giant fields that we have to sow seeds in? Are we ever going to get to the point where we have artificially created food? I don't know, maybe not Soylent Green, but, you know, and is that, if we ever do get to that point, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. It's just interesting to think about.
Man, I was going to mention about your manual labor youth, but you transitioned us so well into like the next bit of the topic, where I kind of wanted to bring up new advances in agriculture.
We can jump around though. That's all right.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. But you mentioned, will we have to always sow a seed in the ground or something? I mean, here in Colorado, marijuana is legal. I do not partake. I just want to put that out there, but it is legal. But one of the things that the marijuana and cannabis industry has given us is this hydroponic science. There's a lot of science that goes into the horticulture of marijuana plants that has developed hydroponics, which is the act of growing plants in water, in nutrient-rich water, and only using water. So you start the seed. I've got a little hydroponic system. You literally start the seed in a growing medium that's made of peat moss, basically. And it's only about a quarter of an inch thick. And then the roots grow down and hit the water well. And you feed the roots everything that they need through the water well.
Okay.
And that's very common now. But when I was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, there's a company there called Vertical Harvest. And it's, if you're ever in Jackson Hole or ever come to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, United States, definitely go do the tour. What they have figured out is how to use hydroponics, grow lights, and solar panels to grow farm crops that supply the local restaurants in a three-story tall building. And they use, so it's all vertical farming. Doesn't take the 50 acres to grow a bunch of stuff, but they grow it with hydroponics, grow lights. They've got their own beehive on site. And it's really fascinating to think of these places, these food deserts, which are places where fresh food isn't available. Think of inner city areas where it costs, not cost effective to ship in fresh food, where if you were to have these vertical harvests or like vertical farms, you could totally get rid of the fresh food desert.
Yeah, that would be really cool. One thing that I guess is kind of tangentially related, something I've always wanted to try is aquaponics. And I know that's not in our show notes, but it just kind of popped into my head.
Oh, no, that's fine.
So aquaponics, just for those that are not aware, is a system of producing food that combines raising aquatic animals like fish and shrimp and stuff with hydroponics. So the way it usually works is you have like these water tanks or, you know, canal systems. There's different ways to do it. Anyway, you have this water, and in the water you're raising, it's usually like tilapia or some, you know, mass produced warm water fish species. And then on top of the water, you have these floating platforms where you grow, I mean, it can be anything. Lettuce is really popular because it requires a lot of water. And so it's a way to get double use out of the same square footage. And, you know, it's something that on a small scale you could easily do in like a garage. So I've always thought it would be kind of cool to look into just as a form of like self-sufficiency and, you know, shoring up food supply against potential cataclysmic events. But
that would be kind of cool. I think I've seen that where the fish eats the molds and algae and stuff that attack the plant roots.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they defecate, the plant absorbs nitrogen and everything from the fish and uses that to grow. It's like a closed environment type of system.
Yeah, it's a really cool, almost symbiotic relationship. So the plants clean the water for the fish and the fish give nutrients to the plants.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be interesting. Do you know, I know I'm putting you on the spot again. Do you know of anywhere that's doing that like in large scale, or is it all still small scale proof of concept type of farms?
So I've seen on like documentaries and just on YouTube videos. It's kind of funny. I watch a lot of YouTube, but when I tell people that I watch a lot of YouTube, they have a very different idea of what my viewing habits would be. I watch a lot of like educational and documentary films and stuff on YouTube. I'm not into like the prank videos and music videos and stuff, but anyway, a little tangent. So I've seen, there was one, I don't remember where it was, but it was about 10 acres was the biggest that I'd seen. And it was far enough south. I want to say it was in New Mexico or Southern California, but it was in a climate where, you know, weather's not really a concern. You don't have to worry about winter kill off and things like that. So if you can do it in a place like that, I think you could, you know, have as many as you want. Since you have these floating platforms that the plants are kind of poking down through, you don't really have a lot of water loss to evaporation. So and then if you have a closed loop system to circulate the water, it might be expensive to stand up, but once it's running, I think your water consumption would be minimal. So
yeah, that's a really cool idea.
The trick to doing it anywhere outside of like, you know, plus or minus 10 or 15 degrees latitude is finding an indoor place that you can do it so that, you know, your fish don't die in the winter and things like that.
That's hard in and of itself, because then you have to figure out how to power your grow lights and make sure that the plants get enough sunlight or artificial sunlight.
Yeah.
So sounds like it's more of something for the tropics.
Yeah, like a lot of food production is.
Yeah. There is a reason why most of our produce comes from Mexico.
That jingle just popped into my head.
The
avocados from Mexico.
Yeah. I guess since we're kind of talking about water and some of the ways that you could use water, there's a company in India. I took an ecology class not too long ago, and I did a research paper on alternative watering methods for agriculture. Yes, I am that kind of a nerd. Like I said, I steamrolled this podcast episode to get Adam onto my wavelength. You're welcome. But there's this company from India that is utilizing smart technology to measure moisture levels in soil and use sensors that monitor the moisture levels and sensor in the soil to only water when the plants need water. And in kind of a tangent, there's a lot of theories and a lot of news opinion pieces that the next big human conflict isn't going to be over oil or coal or any of those. It's going to be over water. And to see that people are going, oh, well, we can use the Internet of Things, probably another podcasting basic overview. Internet of Things is smart technology in everyday life type of thing. But using this computer programs and sensors and diodes to conserve water and only water when necessary, which is kind of cool and very futuristic in my mind, like just to have little nanotechnology all over your field that tells you exactly when to water and where to water and where not to water and that type of thing.
Yeah, that would be really cool. It would, you know, help a couple of different problems. It'll be interesting to see where that goes. I know there was a company, and I forget what it was called, but this was right at the beginning of the Internet of Things. They advertised it as a smart sprinkler system for your lawn, but it was smart in the sense that the controller was connected to Wi-Fi and it would check the weather. So it wouldn't water if it was scheduled to rain. And I mean, this was 10 years ago. I had a coworker that kind of started it as a project on the side. So it's really cool to see where things have come since then.
For sure. Yeah. Anyway, I'll bounce it to you. Anything else that you can think of in the future of farming?
There's been a few that we've brought up during our current events section on past episodes. The one that I remember was from, I want to say it was two or three episodes ago, about the machine that would use a camera and an AI machine learning algorithm to look at plants and say what's a weed and what's not, and zap it with a laser.
I think that's the coolest thing
ever. That was like, honestly, so cool. It's just something out of some sci-fi show, and that's one of those things that I learned about it and I was like, that can't be real. And you realize, oh no, it is real. It's in use today. So
yeah.
And I think that was, so not only as a labor saving device, but you had brought up like herbicides and pesticides. Well, I guess herbicides, this wouldn't really remove the pest problem, but if you've got one of these, you know, driving around your field 24/7 because it's a robot and it doesn't get tired and it doesn't belong to a labor union, you know, you don't have to worry about spraying herbicides. And so then you get better quality crops with higher nutrient density. It's a win-win.
I know I've probably said this before, but I really love living when we do, because I feel like exponentially science is just getting closer and closer to like the sci-fi books that I loved reading when I was younger. Still waiting for that food replicator from the Jetsons, though.
Yeah.
But, thinking about like the technology and science that it took to program this plant identification thing and the laser guided, kind of going back to the old practices, there's a lot of articles that have been coming out about cattle ranching, and basically currently cattle live on giant feedlots. They're funneled into kill lots funneled into meat factories and then sent to the store, and the quality of life is not that great. And you see a lot of articles and people complaining about the greenhouse gases, methane gas and whatnot from the cattle industry. But there's a new movement with cattle ranchers where they're trying to go back to the old open range ideas of actually driving your cattle. And the whole idea is as the cattle eat the grass and then defecate where they eat, they will move on their own because they don't want to be eating their own waste products. And it actually fertilizes the grass, makes it less susceptible to grass fires, and actually strengthens like the soil and topsoil in these cattle farms. And so just, I guess that's one example where new technology and everything isn't the answer. Actually going back to how we used to do it before we had all the technology is best practice.
Yeah, that seems like a fairly elegant solution to the problem of soil depletion, which is a byproduct of monoculture agriculture. So you, in theory, you have a, you know, you're a farmer, you have a few fields, and you know, one year you have your cattle in the field and they're, you know, eating the grass and leaving those tasty nutrients behind. And then the next year you've got a pre-fertilized field, you know, maybe you grow your corn in that one and you just kind of keep rotating around. So it's yeah, sometimes maybe the old ways are better. I don't know. As far as like modern cattle production, and there's a feedlot that is right off the side of the highway here in Idaho that we drive past when we, you know, whenever we go back to Utah to visit family or whatever. And it's, I mean, I've seen it for years and years growing up. So it wasn't really shocking to me, but yeah, if you are not aware of that, it's kind of a bit of a shock to see. And I know that there's been kind of a recent movement to go back to maybe not like, I don't know what you would call it, free range cattle, but trying to source your meat more responsibly, I guess. There's been a bit of a movement that I've seen, you know, in the news and talk to people that try and cut out the middleman and, you know, go and get your beef from the farmer, from the distributor directly. And that's something that my wife and I have actually done for, well, as long as we've been married, and growing up, my family did. In fact, I just before recording this, it was pretty chilly, so I made some chili for dinner tonight, and used some ground beef that's in a little paper package, and it's, you know, from the farm of a family friend, you know, good old grass-fed Emery County, Utah beef. And honestly, it's not that much more expensive. It's about the same price as you would pay for good quality, high-grade beef at the grocery store. But we usually just buy a full cow every year, and it comes pre-cut, pre-packaged. You can say, I want this many steaks, I want this much ground beef, I want this, then you, the farmer takes it to somebody to do the cut and wrap, and you just pay whatever the market price is. There's not any haggling. It's not difficult to do.
I remember doing that when I was younger. My dad used to come home, and my family, I come from a family of cattle ranchers, and we'd always have a quarter of a cow from our from our family ranch that would be in our freezer.
And you probably had the same big deep freeze chest freezer that I had.
Yeah. But I just remember recently my wife and I started doing butcher box, which is kind of similar. You buy wholesale from the source, and it's only been frozen once, so it doesn't have that freeze defrost freeze like you get at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. But I forgot how much I missed fresh beef, because there is a restaurant quality to it. Restaurants always get first. They go to the butchers, and they always get the prime cuts, and you kind of get that when you work with local growers, local farmers, where you don't with other places. I mean, I can go to King Supers, Kroger, City Market. I think that's basic. It's all the same place, but depending on where you're from in the United States, and I can ask for their private select, and it is still not as good as buying from Joe Dirt down the road.
It's really not. And I mean, I'm a little bit lucky because my family's had these relationships with other families down in cattle country. And so, you know, you can say, you can find a farmer that grazes their cattle on grass. If grass fed is your thing, if you want a little bit more fat, you can find somebody that does grain feeding. You can do a combination, which is what we do. And I guess I don't want to stay on this tangent too long, but just quick information, if anybody out there is thinking of doing this. So we buy a whole cow, which is about 500 pounds after it's cut and wrapped, and it's about $2,000. So that works out to be about $5 a pound, which is more than you would pay for ground beef, but less than you would pay for a nice ribeye and prime rib. So it averages out over the entire cow. And then, I mean, that's the most economical way to do it. You can get like a half cow or a quarter cow, and it gets, you know, more expensive per pound. So a quarter cow is going to run you about $700. But I mean, that's, you know, 120-ish pounds usually.
Thereabouts. It depends on the year and the amount of moisture that we've had. But yeah. So
if you're thinking of doing it, that's about how much you can expect. Well, at least at today's market prices.
On the topic of locality, there's a giant production farm here on the Colorado Front Range that my wife and I have a CSA. And I don't know what a CSA means, basically. Or I don't know what the acronym is, but basically what it is you pay a certain amount of money per year, and then every week during growing season, you can go to wherever the farmers are at the farmer's market and fill a bucket or a basket. So we did a half bushel, and every week during the summer, from mid-May until mid-September, you can go get farm fresh tomatoes, farm fresh lettuces, cabbages, potatoes, celeries, all of that stuff for a little bit more expensive than if we were to go to the grocery store. But the quality is a lot better.
Well, the quality is going to be pretty much on par with like Whole Foods, but your prices are going to be significantly less than that.
Yes.
So it may not be certified organic, but it's pretty much, you know, pretty much that.
There's something nice about knowing where your food comes from.
Yeah.
I got to know the guy that runs the farm really well, because he's very proud of his produce. He's just this old man with no teeth that is just happy to do what he's doing. And it's just, you can see the passion when you buy local compared to a nameless wage slave from Arizona or California or Mexico, you know?
Yeah, and the focus on that a local production farm has is definitely more on quality over quantity. So yeah, we, with recently moving, we're going to have to find some new supply for our produce, but that's definitely the way to go if you can swing it. And you know, if you live on in the inner city, unfortunately, it's a little bit more difficult. But you know, maybe with some of these alternative farming methods, then people that live in these food deserts can, you know, grow some herbs on your windowsill, or you know, grow some tomatoes on your patio or something. I don't know. One of the easiest things that I've ever grown has been green onions. I don't think I've bought green onions for years. Well, that's not true. We usually buy a bunch, like one bunch in the spring. We cut the tops off, stick them in the, you know, in the dirt out in the garden. And then as they grow, you can like split and propagate more, and they just grow all year. Like you barely have to water them. They'll grow in anything. And yeah. So that's a good place to start, I guess.
Those are great. I wish I had the name as you were talking about these food deserts. There's a rap music artist from Aurora, Colorado that raps about food sustainability, and actually has, if you buy his set, like CDs, it goes towards urban gardening and taking these vacant lots and turning those into community gardens to try and get people more or less off the streets and actually into a hobby that is beneficial for the community. And it's kind of a cool idea. I heard about it on Colorado Public Radio not too long ago and just went, oh, I should have written his name down.
I'm trying to remember now. Was it Top Gear or Grand Tour where they tried to do the same thing in Detroit? I think it was the Grand Tour.
Oh, it was one of the two. Yeah. But I mean, there is pluses. There's definitely pluses to people actually figuring out how to grow things in the city. You go to certain parts of big cities and it just, it's dirty, disgusting. And like there's great, I feel more at ease when I see pieces like little green belts or places where things are growing. It's not just concrete weeds and graffiti. Like,
yeah, agreed. And there's tangible health benefits to having green spaces. So,
yeah. Oh man, we've been rambling a while. There's so much more that we could talk about. But I think we should probably start to wrap it up. The big thing that I did want to say about the big worry of, with food production for me is seeing these corporate takeovers. And I know people will go, oh, they ripping on corporations. That's easy. That's a scapegoat, whatnot. But unfortunately, in agriculture, there is a lot of truth in ripping on the corporations. I can't remember the name of the seed company, Monsanto or something like that.
Yeah, Monsanto.
Have genetically engineered their seeds so that only they control the plants that produce seeds. So you can't create heirloom seeds if you buy a seed pack from them. And even if you could, if you're a farmer and they come and they'll come and do plant tests, DNA tests to see if they have these trademarked plants, and they will charge you if you have Monsanto plants in your fields, even if you didn't buy them, which is really hard because corn, which is technically a grass, is pollinated by air. It's not pollinated by bees or birds or other insects. And so when a wind gust goes, the pollen from one farmer's field, say he uses Monsanto stuff, will go and it'll pollinate another farmer's field who doesn't use Monsanto stuff. The flowers will turn into fruit. Monsanto comes and collects samples and goes, oh, he's already paid us for this corn crop. But this guy who has Monsanto corn ears growing in his field who didn't buy from us is breaking the law, breaking our trademark law, so we're going to fine him, type of thing. And so, unfortunately, corporations are killing agriculture, at least in America. Europe may be onto something with the non-GMO movement that's going on over there.
Yeah, unfortunately, my knowledge of European farming is limited to Clarkson's Farm on Amazon Prime, but it's a concern. I mean, there's fewer and fewer small farmers every year. Every year, a farmer somewhere retires and doesn't have anybody to take over the farm, and so all he can do is sell it, right? I mean, he's got to have money to retire on. And it's not like farming comes with a 401k.
Right.
So that's, I mean, you recently bought a house. I recently bought a house. And it's surprising how much land costs and how hard it is to break into that. That's something that my wife and I did look at, actually, is, you know, what would it take to bail out of the the corporate America and, you know, just do our own thing, you know, 10, 20 acres. And with my background, it's wouldn't be terrible. I mean, I have the knowledge. I'm not as young and spry as I used to be, but that's what kids are for, I guess. And but it's so hard to break into that if you don't have, like, you know, a family line of farmers that are leaving you land as an inheritance. There's not really a lot of funding programs in the U.S. to help people break into farming as a lifestyle and a livelihood, unfortunately.
And even if you wanted to, in the Western United States, I don't know how it is in the Eastern United States or in Europe or Africa or Asia or anywhere where there's abundances of water. And I guess I should take Africa out of that, for the most part. There are rainforests there, but here in Colorado and the Colorado River Basin, there's water rights that you have to deal with. If you want to break in, say you want to become a farmer and it's your lifelong dream, and you finally raise enough to buy this new patch of land from somebody that just retired and sold it to you, or sold it to the bank. Bank sold it to you. You don't get his water rights. His family may have been there for 200 years and has first rights on the river, and now you are new guy on the block and you have last rights on the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are at the beck and call of all your neighbors who need the water just as much as you do. So if you're last man on the river, there's a chance you're not getting any water.
Even if you're geographically upstream from somebody.
Right.
It's, yeah, that's a good point. And that is something we noticed, is a lot of, if you are able to afford the acreage, most of the time it does not come with the water rights. So, and that's something that's kind of hard to understand unless you've lived out here on you know, on this, in this area, but it's a harsh reality.
You moved into an agricultural center that gets a lot more moisture than where you used to live, so I don't know if water rights are a deal as big of a deal with more. You
it's so where I live, there's not a ton of rivers. There's the Snake River and there's a handful of tributaries, but our water table is also extremely high. It's high enough that where I live, nobody has a basement. You can dig down. Really, you only have to go about 3 or 4 feet before you hit groundwater. So,
oh wow,
it's much different from growing up in the middle of BLM Central where I did.
Fair, but I don't know. I don't want to dissuade anybody. I feel like if you're listening to this podcast and you want to be a farmer, do it. Because as the older generation is moving out and moving on, and as the media is basically telling you that farming's dead, we need people excited about farming to kind of save us from corporate monopolies in agriculture like Monsanto.
Yeah, and some fresh eyes and fresh perspective may be a good thing. You know, with all of the technological advances, the future small-time farmer of America, you know, maybe he has a minor in computer science. We don't know. Thanks for taking the time to listen to our ramblings on the subject of agriculture in the modern world. For the mindfulness moment this week, since it's the week of Thanksgiving, we just wanted to take some time to say thank you to all of our supporters. As of the last episode, we have now had our podcast downloaded in 11 separate countries and across all of the continents except for Africa, which is amazing. And in addition to that, we wanted to each share something that we're personally thankful for. And so, in addition to all of you amazing listeners, the thing that I am thankful for is my dog. It might sound kind of cheesy. So my dog is 2.5 years old. We got her just before the pandemic really took off here in the U.S. We got her 2.5 years ago. She's been with us through multiple moves, including this recent move out of state. And the company that I work for has been very proactive in their handling of the pandemic, which means I have been working from home almost exclusively for 2 years. There was about a month that I went back to working in the office when the coronavirus had calmed down, but then with the recent surge, I've been back working from home again. And through all of that, she has been the most amazing constant companion. My wife teaches school, and so she's gone for quite a long time during the day. And my dog has been awesome. She's been right here keeping me company, making sure I don't lose my mind being locked up inside staring at computer screens for forever. So that's what I'm thankful for.
That's awesome. Companionship is so important right now. I would like to echo Adam in saying that I am very appreciative of all of you listeners, everybody that's taken time or taken a chance on two unknown podcast hosts. I hope you're as entertained as it is entertaining for us to come together and kind of chat about life and everything going on every week. And I really do thank you all for coming and joining us on this journey. It's really cool to see the growth and see the development of this community. As far as personally, what I'm most thankful for, this year has been really hard. As somebody that works on the front line and has kind of had to be in person, it's really hard to think of things that you're thankful for when you're understaffed and beat down and just exhausted and all of that. But I really do, I want to say thanks or say that I'm thankful for like my friends and family and just the chance that I have to be here every week with my cousin. I'm very thankful for him to help produce this and everything that he does on the podcast. I'm thankful for my wife for everything that she does, everything that she puts up with, as I am not a nice person sometimes when I've had a stressful day at work. And everybody else that just is a part of my life and kind of helps keep me up. So I guess kind of like Adam, I am thankful for companionship as well.
Yeah, last couple of years, I think everybody's realizing how important companionship is. Even people like me that claim to like to be alone.
Well, in the spirit of Thanksgiving, if you've listened this far, I'd like to challenge you. You can tweet at us or comment or tag us on Instagram or TikTok or any of our other links. What are you most thankful for going into this season? Even if you're not an American and don't celebrate Thanksgiving, like, it's nice to take a moment to be thankful.
For next week's show, we wanted to relax a little bit from the structured topics algorithm that we've been following. And one of my favorite TV shows growing up was the trivia game show Jeopardy. On Jeopardy, they sometimes had a category called Potpourri, which was just a bunch of unrelated leftover questions that they didn't have time for on previous episodes. So that seemed like a pretty good fit, and that's what we're going to call next week's show. We'll be taking a look at video games, books, movies, pop culture stuff, or any questions that you as listeners may feel like sending in. So tune in. We'll see you then.